The Summit Land Conservancy has secured millions in federal funding to help save an alfalfa farm there on Old Ranch Road. In the studio with details, I have the director of the Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox. Good morning.
Good morning.
So this actually would only pay for half of the purchase price?
So we have an agreement with the Osgathorpe family to purchase a conservation easement on the farm. And the federal program that we applied for will pay half of the value of the conservation easement. So, you know, a couple of years ago, the Summit Land Conservancy did a lot of outreach and listening. We got a grant from the Land Trust Alliance. We did a big strategic plan, and we had focus groups. And we asked people, what do you want us to save? And one of the things that came to the top was the ranch on Old Ranch Road. And this didn't really surprise us, given, you know, how critical it is, how beautiful it is, how much people love to ride their bikes past it, look at it. It's visible from most of the places that we recreate around the Snyderville Basin as well. So when the family approached us and said they were interested in selling a conservation easement, we were pretty excited about that. The purchase price is based on an appraisal, and that appraisal is based on comparable sales and sales that were reported on the MLS. So sales are not always reported on the MLS, but so, you know, this is a really well-documented appraisal. I guess that's the point. So we submitted all of our documents to the NRCS. That's a federal program in the Department of Agriculture. And we've used this program 4 or 5 times already in Eastern Summit County. They have a couple of different programs where they'll purchase conservation easements or help purchase conservation easements. So we're familiar with the program, and we submitted the documents for this and two other projects. And we were informed that the project was eligible in June. And we were informed in September that the money to purchase the Osgathorpe farm has actually been transferred to the state of Utah and assigned to that property.
So we're talking about, 158 acres? And that is, the appraisal was done for agricultural land, right? I mean, what's it zoned as?
Well, the appraisal was done based on the base density zoning, which is between 7 and 8 units at this point. So it's, I think, 1 per 20. So it would be a large lot subdivision, kind of like, is, you know, across the road, quarry, ranch estates, those types of places. At base density, you know, somebody could always come in and ask for a change. You know, we see that happen from time to time. But the family doesn't want to develop it. You know, the Osgathorpe families have never sold land for development in the Park City area. And, you know, they are dedicated ranchers, farmers. And this particular parcel, you know, if you look at it as a 150-acre farm on Old Ranch Road, where you sort of take it out of context. So it's important to look at it in context both as the natural resource for the Snyderville Basin, because it's just across the road from Swanner, it's just downstream from Quarry Mountain, it's, you know, right there from Round Valley. So it's part of a larger recreational natural resource complex for the Snyderville Basin. And it's also part of a larger picture for the Osgathorpe's overall ranching operation. They have property across the state of Utah, and this is an important piece of that.
Okay. So total purchase price, $14.3 million then? Did I do the math?
$14.2 million is the total purchase price for the conservation easement. So what we've been able to do is you know, we still need to find $5.6 million from the community, and that's matching funds. So the federal government pays 50% of the conservation easement value. Now, the easement, it's development rights. The development rights are valued at $17.7 million. So, and then the family has agreed to take a significant amount off of that purchase price, $3.5 million. And then we've got 8.7 from the federal government, so we need the additional 5.5 from the community, 5.6 from the community.
So how long do you have to collect that?
So the transaction will close in 2 phases. There will be a March 2018 phase, and we need most of that 5.6 by March of 2018. And then the federal funding will come through probably in 2019 to complete the transaction.
And now, what rights do the Osgathorpes then have to the property? They get to continue to use it as they always have?
That's right. They'll continue to use it as a farm. You know, they could farm something somewhat different out there. The NRCS is particular about what type of farming can happen. It could not be turned into a feedlot, for example. It could not be turned into a sod farm that rips up the soil. the NRCS, you know, grew out of the Great Depression, and so it's really supporting sustainable agriculture, which the Osgathorpes have been doing anyway. So there are some constraints, but it does need to remain as a farm, and the Osgathorpes have the water rights, and they'll continue to use it as a farm. They are retaining one housing right to build a farmer's house near where the rest of the barns are on the property, because at some point in the future, you know, if it's organic farming or something like that, there may need to be a more regular presence of a farmer on the property.
Mm-hmm. So they do maintain all the water rights then?
They have very old senior water rights for the property, yes.
Okay, but that doesn't come with part of this?
It does. The water rights need to be tied to the conservation easement because it's really hard. I mean, if we're gonna say that they're going to be able to maintain farming forever, and it's pretty difficult to maintain farming in our region without water rights. So that is part of the transaction.
Yeah. Does this also prohibit then the property from ever being used as a helicopter landing pad for?
It will.
Sundance Film Festival?
You know, zoning also makes a difference. So, you know, the conservation easement will prohibit a certain number of things, usually, you know, related to structures and things that are built. It's really very difficult to imagine what's going to happen 50 or 100 years down the road. Take drones, for example. And so we really do have to rely on again, there's a larger picture. You know, every property exists within a zoning district, within a legislative district, a community of some type. So a conservation easement doesn't exclude you from having to follow the rules of law in your community.
And then in terms of how the public can use the property, is it basically no trespassing because it's a working farm?
I'm glad you asked that, because this is a different transaction from some of the other open space purchases that the community here has made. You know, for example, with Bonanza Flat, the city bought that land outright and is now the owner. When you do that, though, you pay for fee title, you pay more money, and then you also have to be responsible for the maintenance and upkeep. The only way to save the Osgathorpe Ranch on Old Ranch Road, really, because the property value is so high, the only way to do it was to work in partnership with the family and purchase a conservation easement that allowed them to continue the farming and ranching. Obviously, farming and ranching, you know, it's a working land. So it's different from, you know, Round Valley or places like that where nobody's trying to farm. The family has offered cross-country trail access for the wintertime, just as they do in the Land of Oz in Round Valley. But the summertime, it would probably be very limited or no public access because they're farming it.
Yeah. I guess, and really what is even more amazing to me is that, you know, back in the, whenever, 1990, when we purchased the entire McPolin farm for just over $4 million, we got the kit and caboodle. Here we're paying three times as much and have just the easement.
Well, again, I'm glad you brought that up, because actually the community is paying $5.6 million for 158 acres on Old Ranch Road. Every local dollar is leveraged three times if you look at the value of the conservation easement, five times if you look at the value of fee title. So we're saving a beautiful piece of property for about the same amount of money as we usually pay or frequently pay to save property. And we don't have any carrying costs going forward. So we aren't going to have to pay for the weed control or the maintenance and the upkeep of the property, because the family will continue to farm it.
Okay, real quick, you've got some hops that are harvesting and making some beer as we speak?
That's right. We had 30 wonderful volunteers last week come out and scour the hillsides, and we harvested 75 pounds of hops, which is a record for us. They are in the vat at the Wasatch Brew Pub as we speak, and they will be available at Hoppy Hour on Saturday, September 23rd at the Wasatch Brew Pub. That starts at 6 o'clock. Tickets are $15 at the door. I think you can get them online at wesaveland.org also.
Okay, anything else?
Drink beer, save land.
Okay. Cheryl, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, the Park City Board of Education meeting this morning here in just about 40 minutes in the studio with a quick run through of the agenda. I have Superintendent Amber Conley. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, just before we get to the agenda, Park City School District, are we doing anything to reassure our students about that may be part of the DACA program? I mean, we're hearing a lot about that, of course, today.
We do. You know, we have very strong Latinos in Action organizations here in Park City, and we have community members that have met individually and with those students And we have a community-based organization. If you want more information, contact Mohiki, and have been working directly with any of the students that might fall under the DACA.
Yeah, and I guess that kind of is a prelude into a discussion item at the board meeting, the year of safe and health. I mean, a focus on school safety. And I think when people are afraid, that doesn't create a kind of an aura of safety there.
Totally agree. And that's one of the things that we continue to talk about is if our students aren't both mentally, emotionally, physically well, they're certainly not going to learn in our classrooms. And this is one of those things that as the nation faces the controversies, the nation faces these types of civil unrest. We are in the middle of it as well.
Yeah.
But I would say that Park City, again, being Park City, we have amazing community organizations that wraps their hands around our students and provide that support for them.
Yeah. So what does the board need to know in terms of the discussion today? What's happening here with that?
Around the safe and healthy?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a, if we have about at least an hour, I can go through everything we're doing, but it's really exciting. I'm going to start with safety. You know, one of the things I was trained right after Columbine, grew up in Colorado, started my career in Colorado, and really changed the face of what we did in schools. And having that background, and then again, after again being in Colorado after the Platte County hostage situation, it really gave me a different perspective. So when I came to Park City, and again, we view Park City as a very safe, very supportive community, but we don't want to wait for something to happen. And so looking at our schools, there's some things that we really need to work on. And there's some things that we can do to maximize what we already have. You know, making sure our perimeter doors are always locked, making better perimeters and boundaries, especially at our elementary schools. So signage, some natural barriers. Of course, fencing, we get into fencing and we get into upset neighbors of messing with their view. But I'm going to tell you, if it comes to keeping a child safe, I'm going to err on the child safety. So looking at fencing, one of the biggest projects is looking at our school entrances. And so we have actually had these plans since 2013, and we're put on hold for various reasons. But we're going back to those drawings. And so for every school to have some major, some minor adjustments to how people enter the building. And then once they enter the building, a visitor management system. Another thing, in fact, Chief Carpenter is out in the waiting area, that we have such an amazing partnership both with the police department, with the fire, and the sheriff's office with what we do around safety. We're planning some tabletop active shooter activities where we get everyone together, we get our people together, and we go through scenarios. Another thing that we're looking at is an emergency response database system where it houses all of our information from all of our maps to our entrances, making sure that our police and our fire have all of that up-to-date information.
So what have we budgeted for all of this to happen?
You know, we had this budgeted in 2013 through our capital account. And so, again, this is money that's been set aside. And so really what the board will need to do is to give us purchasing authority to move forward.
Okay. So does McPullen Playground then get fenced?
You know, we are looking at some different options for McPullen. We're looking at both natural barriers and some fencing and some very clear signage around boundaries. I think that we've had a number of students, and thank goodness we have, again, such great staff that are able to manage our students. But, you know, we have students that do get upset and have ran out the door, and it's one of those things that we've got to be able to be prepared for. Which, you know, when you come back to the safe and healthy, I think that's another thing that we're doing really well. As we've hired our assistant superintendent of student wellness, already providing training for all of our staff around behavior, and how to de-escalate situations, how to manage our students better when they're in that cycle of coercion. And so we've also added support with a behavior specialist, with two new school psychologists. So that support for our classroom teachers has been huge.
Any news on current enrollment? I know final numbers aren't due till October 1, but are we on track for what we budgeted?
You know, August is always lower than what's projected. I mean, for the last 4 or 5 years, August, or you know, the August count comes in low. But so far, we've met our projections. You know, and I think it's important for the community to know that in the last 5 years, we've increased by 500 students. And that's, you know, in a small district, That's significant. So we're up to about over 5,000 students, pre-K to 12. And as we know, our bond failed. But as we move forward, our biggest concern is what's happening inside those classrooms. And as we build more trailers or cottages, I heard a new term for our cottages, a cabana. I'm not sure if I would go with a cabana. But, you know, the safety gets into that discussion as well.
Strategic planning, the board's going to be discussing that, again, this postponing the bond until what you're calling the vision and values of the community are addressed through a comprehensive process of strategic planning. And we've heard that that planning could take 12 to 18 months. I guess it's just that we were in such a big rush in 2015. It feels like we've lost a lot of momentum there. But what's changed? Because in 2015, we were told we couldn't wait 2 years, and now we're talking about waiting another 2 years.
Couple of things on that. Strategic planning is, it's done about every 5 to 7 years, and we're 7 years out. And so when you look at strategic planning, the vision statement of who do we want to become, and then the values of what are the values of the community so that we can live up to those values and provide those opportunities for our students to ensure that they're productive citizens as they graduate. And so our board is really dedicated, first of all, to listening, to looking at all of the options. And this is one way to provide a really strong foundation of what's the vision, what's the mission, why do we show up every single day, and what are the true values? And, you know, whether it takes 6 months, 8 months, 12 months, you know, I don't think that we need to put a time on that. What I think that we need to do is make sure that we're engaging the community as broadly as we can to ensure that when we do get the information back from strategic planning and we build the implementation plan, that we're able to fulfill those values. And with, you know, with the bond, different board, different set of situations, again, I'm going to say we are growing. I think that that's certainly, it can't be argued in our data. I would even say it was interesting. I was at Meet Our New Principal, and of the five families that I had individual conversations with, every single one of them for out of state. Indiana, New York, Nevada, California. And so I think that that's something that is hard at the same time for the community, because our community has changed even in the last 4 years. And as I start my fifth year, community has changed in those 5 years.
So we will have a new strategic plan then before we move on as to how and when we bond and how much?
Absolutely. When you look at, you know, I'm going to say linear. Being a former math teacher, I love putting things linear, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. But strategic planning is that foundation. And then from the strategic plan, you build that implementation plan. The implementation is what we call the district learning plan. Everyone's like, what's the difference? The district learning plan is the implementation plan for the strategic plan. And it was built exactly that way. When I came in 2013, the strategic plan had just been finished, within the last couple of years. And it was fairly, I don't know if easy is the right word, but it was fairly comprehensive as to what the district learning plan did to meet those values and those goals. And I would say once that's planned, we really can then look at master planning. And I would say a couple of things that have changed. The park and ride out at Ecker has certainly changed our view of what we want to be able to do at Ecker. There's some other opportunities that the board is very, very interested in. While it's a frustration to hear that the community will spend millions of dollars for open space and yet not really willing to purchase for the schools, I think that we have an opportunity to engage the community and say, we need your support because we have children to educate.
And real quick, I saw this in the Jeremy Ranch newsletter last week, a reading-only homework pilot program taking place this year, and it's going to be discussed at this morning's board meeting. So how much homework do we actually have happening in elementary grades?
So thank you. This is a soapbox for me, so I apologize. All of the research and being both a teacher, a principal at all the levels, and then now being at the district level, I am not a major supporter of homework for elementary besides reading. You look at massive amounts of meta-analysis for homework, and it's not there of what, you know, the what it could produce. And so what we're doing, well, and so to go back to answer your question, we have students that were spending their entire after-school time in our after-school program, which is really a time to enrich their learning and intervene, just spending on homework. And we've been tracking this for the last couple of years. And it became a major frustration, not only for the students, but for us, because we weren't getting the results of our after-school program. But most importantly, our staff. I mean, they're sitting there wanting to do that, those enrichment. And so we're really excited. We've spent the last year as an administrative team talking about our philosophy of homework. We all agree that we need to make some changes.
So we're going to do a pilot program. I mean, what are you going to be measuring to make sure that there are to see whether or not this is implemented district-wide?
Well, the first thing you look at is a baseline data. You know, is reading going to increase or decrease? And so we have our baseline data. And right now, you know, I can't say enough about how we have used our data in really making decisions. To say that our graduation rate has gone from 89% to 97% in 4 years is tremendous. And so data is everything to us. And so we're going to look at the data. You know, are our reading scores at least staying stable? Are our students unplugged? Because if you look at safe and healthy, one of the very first things that that psychologists say, that the doctors say, give time to our students to be creative, to unplug, and really have that downtime. And that's our goal.
Okay, need to let you go. Thanks,
Thank
Ember.
You.
Superintendent of Park City Schools, Ember Conley. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:34. Good morning. Well, as we've reported, Summit County and the Park City Police Public Safety Dispatch Centers have merged in the studio to talk about why this was done and how it benefits the community. I have Park City Police Chief Wade Carpenter joining us on the phone. Will be Summit County Dispatch Manager Nick Wilkinson. So good morning to you, Wade.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So whose idea was this? Was it state mandated?
Well, in part, actually, this wasn't state mandated at this point, but legislation is definitely directing state resources. It's incentivizing dispatches to merge statewide.
Okay. So was Park City the only municipality in the county that had its own dispatch center? I mean, what about Camas and Oakley and Francis?
So those all fell under the county sheriff's office, and then we had our own dispatch as well.
Okay. So are those communities then also contributing to making this happen?
So the way that works is the county is providing services for the unincorporated area. I do know that Camas City does participate in that as well. And as far as Oakley, I'm not sure what those agreements are.
Okay. So I've heard estimates of cost about $600,000 to implement?
That's correct. $600,000 is the implementation for the personnel, and then there's another $108,000 for construction costs. And then the county obviously has another portion of that, which is another $108,000 for construction costs.
So is the $600,000 just for Park City Municipal?
Correct. Well, that's for our portion of Park City Municipal, plus the $108,000, which will also be contributed to cover those overall expenditures.
Okay. But the thinking is that in a few years, this is going to more than pay for itself?
Well, yeah. The idea being is through redundancy, the state has merged a lot of resources through Utah Communications Authority, which is being run right now by former Sheriff Dave Edmonds. So that board is a quasi-government board that is funded part through state government, through the governor's office, and also has private funding as well.
So do we have people losing their jobs over the merger?
So no, we actually work very closely with Summit County HR, RHR, to ensure that the employees that wanted to make the transitions were maintained and made the transition.
Okay. So Nick Wilkinson joins us on the phone. Nick, you had reported to the Park City Council last week that the merger has already resulted in some calls being 50% faster. How did you come up with that result?
Oh, as far as the calls, we've reduced our 911 call transfers over to the, generally the 911 call would come in for any police service in the past. And we would transfer that call over to the Park City Police Department Dispatch Center. And as part of that, it takes, 60 seconds to 90 seconds to determine an address and jurisdiction and if the call would need to be transferred. And through co-locating, we've reduced that transfer time for police-related calls.
Yeah. Was that a problem? We've got so many silver things, both in Park City and Summit County, that there were, getting people just not know where to go?
You know, it was more of a problem of technology, in that a lot of the cell phone towers and also any landline phone would get routed to the Summit County Call Center, because we're the primary public safety answering point. So essentially all fire and medical 911 calls are serviced by the center at the Summit County Sheriff's Office. And then any police-related calls or law enforcement-related calls in the Park City Municipal Jurisdiction, that's where we would transfer the call. And we were seeing, I think last year in pulling the report, we were seeing around, I think it was 1,155. I could be just a few off there, that we transferred from the Summit County over to Park City for law enforcement emergency services.
So everyone has been moved over now to the Justice Center?
Correct, yes.
And you're going to do construction around them? Or what's happening there in terms of the improvements that need to be made?
I can answer that.
Go ahead, Nick.
Basically, we have two. The nice thing is we have a little bit of redundancy for our essential services, I guess, or our critical infrastructure, in that Park City Police Department has an existing, it's a three-console call center that they have been dispatching out of. And our plan is to move all of the call and radio and dispatch services to the Park City Police Center for a period of time that it takes us to do construction, so that it's seamless, and we also don't have any, they're not tearing down our walls when we're trying to talk somebody through a CPR over the phone or something to that extent.
So as was reported earlier this year, some of the Park City dispatchers not too happy about the merger, but it sounds like we're okay with that now, Wade?
Yeah, you know, anytime there's change is difficult, and we obviously have to focus on the health, safety, and welfare of the public and our community. And certainly in making a transition, it's tough. But I will say that Summit County and Park City, both of our county councils and city councils, as well as our managers, have made our employees a priority and have made sure that they've had the opportunity to keep their benefits intact and their wages, so that they were fair market value for the jobs they were performing.
Yeah. So with about a 25% ethnic population, within the city limits, are there set rules about how many, if any, bilingual dispatchers we have on shifts?
You want to take
it? Go ahead. Yeah, I can answer that. There's no real set rules. We have some that have limited fluency in Spanish. I will say it is a priority. We also have a couple of language line services that we interconnect with to help in communication if we get somebody that is not a native English speaker through AT&T, and then we have another backup that they bring online and provide a translator right there, similar to if we were working over like the TTY service with somebody that was hearing impaired.
Yeah, so is that a goal then, to have at least one Spanish-speaking dispatcher working?
Oh, it's certainly a goal that we're working toward. But in recruiting for those key positions, it's been a bit of a challenge, as a lot of the they can find sometimes higher-paying jobs in corporate America with their bilingual skills, but We do, that is one of our questions, and we do try to recruit people that speak different languages. A lot of our deputies and jailers also speak, quite a few speak Spanish, and then we have things as far as like Mandarin, Chinese, or Korean that some of them speak. But
okay, and Wade, just one other question for you. We heard that 95% of the calls for the Park City Police Department were 911 calls being made to the 615-5500 number. So that's the number listed on the webpage. Does that make sense not to have a separate number for 911 calls?
The reality is those are routed in just as you won't notice a difference if they call the 5500 number. People really are accustomed to using that number, and so we wanted to retain that number. If you call that number, it will go through to our dispatch. They'll pick it up, public safety dispatch. Somebody from the outside calling in won't recognize the difference of those calls. And the service, obviously, we feel to be an enhanced service. The reality with dispatch is both Nick and I have struggled on staffing, and that's kind of a national trend because it's a very difficult, tough job. And so we're always constantly trying to keep to full staff. And the reality is this gives us the ability by combining our resources that we can staff those positions even better.
Okay. So again, that 615-5500, that would go to 911, or it stays within your office?
It's not 911. It's a call. It's a service line. Is that correct, Nick?
Yeah.
Yeah, Leslie. So we have two things in the call center. One's called an administrative line, which would be we handle some emergency calls on that if they call in through the regular phone number. And then we have the 911 line. There's 10 or 11 administrative trunks that come in, and I think we have 8 911 trunks. So we try to encourage people that have, say, non-emergency calls where really life isn't on the line to call in through the administrative line to keep the 911 trunks open for the true emergency service request.
Okay, so but that is 24/7 then, the administrative line as well.
Yeah, they're handled at the exact same, through the exact same headset at the exact same control console. So it's pretty seamless. The only differentiation is one has a higher priority ringtone than the other. But yes, it would be the same dispatcher answering both the 911 call or the admin call.
Okay. That's Nick Wilkinson and Park City Police Chief Wade Carpenter. Thanks for your time, you guys.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, a notice of intent to prepare an environmental impact statement for a fish killing in the Upper Uintas has been published in the Federal Register. Now on the phone to talk to us about what's being planned is Matt McKell. He's the cutthroat biologist with the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. Good morning to you, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this public notice went out for the project. Still a lot of work to do, though, before this can happen. What is taking place at this point?
We've done some preliminary look at that drainage system to look at fish distribution, where we have trout that we want and where we have trout that we'd like to replace. And then, of course, the EIS is being prepared. We've got some genetics work that we're looking at for various parts of the drainage to determine where we need to treat and where we don't.
So what this wouldn't happen, I guess, until next summer, next fall, but why are we doing this?
Well, we've got native cutthroat trout in various parts of the state, and one of our charges as the Fish and Wildlife Agency within the state is to conserve and enhance the fish that we do have, the native component. We, of course, are also charged with providing sport fish opportunities throughout the state, and so this is kind of a balance between those two, but we've selected streams that would be good candidates for restoration projects and may not have a huge impact on the public by doing that, but would provide another place for the native only to reside.
Yeah, so how did these non-native or hybridized fish get into the streams?
So the state, and I'll say we because there's still a lot of things that we that we're learning, but there was a time decades ago, and actually not so long ago, that we provided sport fish opportunities or fishing opportunities in every stream or water that we could. And so we, as a state, back in the 40s and even earlier, 40s, 50s, 60s, and prior to that, stocked rainbow trout and lots of other even non-native Yellowstone cutthroat trout quite a bit. And that's what we have in the West Fork, Smith Fork, is the a little bit of rainbow trout and a little bit of Yellowstone cutthroat trout and a little bit of Colorado River cutthroat trout. So we did it ourselves, and now we're in some of those situations. We're trying to undo the things that we did in the past.
So why is that a bad thing to have those other fish in there that are non-native?
Yeah, as a conservation effort, to have the non-native mixed in, it's less valuable from a conservation or a, say that those fish were listed for or petitioned for listing, and they have been under the Endangered Species Act, then we have less management ability. So if we can show the Fish and Wildlife Service and the public that we're doing what we can to conserve and to build those species of native fish, then we have more flexibility in our management.
Yeah, it seems a bit ironic, though, that you have to kill them all, though, to make that happen.
Well, that's not necessarily the case. There, we do have in that specific stream or drainage, we do have some little pockets in the headwaters in the very top of the drainage that have some remnant or leftover native genetics, like genetically pure Colorado River cutthroat trout. And then we've got stretches where they're mixed with Yellowstone cutthroat trout. We see evidence of rainbow trout in there as well. So, yeah, in those reaches where we do see a mix, we do have to kill everything. Although there are some species in that stream, the sculpin, the mottled sculpin. There are also mountain sucker, which is a native fish, and speckled dace, which is a little native minnow. And those are fish that we can try to salvage prior to a treatment and hold during the treatment and then put back. But the cutthroat trout or the hybrids, it's not, there's no easy way to tell, to look at one of them in that mixing zone and tell that this is a 100% pure fish, you know, it has only pure genes versus a fish that might have a mix. They could look identical.
Now, we're only talking about 12 stream miles. I mean, that's nothing when you think about all of the streams in the wilderness.
That's right.
Yeah. So is it just kind of a pilot project just to see how it works? Or?
No, we've been doing projects like this for years across Utah. And in northern Utah, the last 5 years or so, we've done a handful of little projects. In fact, one that we're working on in Rich County that is actually essentially complete, covered about 20 stream miles of Bonneville cutthroat trout habitat. So, yeah, it's not really a private pilot program, but we're taking that a relatively small drainage, as you indicated, and bringing it back to native. Just, you know, if we can do that a piece at a time for those areas that are where it's feasible, then we'll do that.
Hmm. So what kind of problem do you have? I mean, you've got a bunch of dead fish. You have to get in there and then clean them all out as well?
In those areas where it could create a bad image to the public or a nuisance to other species, yeah, we'd probably pick up some of the fish. But a lot of times we leave them in the stream and it provides food for invertebrates to boost those populations so that when the fish do come back in, there's plenty of food in the stream. They degrade naturally pretty quickly on their own, too. So a couple weeks later, we could go in and not see anything, no evidence of a treatment.
Hmm. And so the substance that's used to kill the fish, retinone, is what, short-lived then?
It is, and it's used in such small concentrations. We put a relatively small amount in the stream. It's effective in removing fish, but it doesn't affect any other wildlife at those concentrations. They say a bird or a small animal or even a large animal would have to drink thousands of gallons of treated water at those concentrations to have any effect.
Okay. So, again, I guess you're just asking for public comment. You've got, till the end of the month to do
right.
that?
Yep, that's right.
And they can just find that by going, what, just online to the federalregister.gov?
Yep, the Federal Register, and then they could search West Fork, Smith Fork.
Okay. Anything else you think people ought to know, Matt?
No, I would like to say that the cutthroat trout, that having that native species on the landscape is a good thing. Just having the natural heritage of the drainage of the Uintas. But cutthroat trout are a beautiful fish. Up there, they have orange bellies and nice deep red throat slashes. They're just a very beautiful fish.
Okay. Hey, Matt, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
Matt McKell, again, is the cutthroat biologist with the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. KPCW News Time, 8:53. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. The Ziegfeld Theater presenting the production of Next to Normal. It's opening this week at the Egyptian Theater and runs through September 17th. On the phone with details, I have the director of the production, Rick Ray. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
So tell us what Next to Normal is all about.
Next to Normal tells the story of an American family where the mother is struggling with a very severe form of bipolar disorder. And as the show unfolds, it tackles mental health issues, but it also becomes about coping in general and about, in all of our lives, different kinds of obstacles that we work through. And it ends up being about a lot more than just mental health. It's a very beautiful show that most people can really relate to.
Yeah, it's a rock musical?
It is, yes. It has a gorgeous rock score, and we have a live orchestra with a full rock band as well as strings.
Wonderful. And how many actors have you got in this production?
This production is typically done with six. We've actually done it with nine, so we've added three actors who are also understudies for those roles that do backup vocals, as well are involved with some really neat transitions that we've added to the show.
Okay. I'm not familiar with it, but the play had won the Pulitzer Prize. It's got three Tony Awards, so it's got some public appeal to it, huh?
Absolutely, and it's kind of developed a really strong following due to just how good the writing is, how impactful it's been on so many people's lives.
Yeah. So the announcements that we're running say that there are adult themes to this. Can you talk about that? Just what? I'm suicide, I'm guessing, or?
Yeah. While this isn't, a explicit show or anything like that, it deals with some very heavy themes. And while there's nothing extremely graphic at all or explicit, it does touch on some nerves. And so we advise people going into the show to just mentally prepare for that and to know that it is a show about coping, and it talks about some of the different things that people cope with, from loss to mental health issues and other things. But the show does leave the audience ultimately on an inspiring note, and it takes you on a roller coaster, but it ends with a lot of hope.
Okay. Again, as I mentioned, it opens Friday night, and then we'll run Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then again, I'm guessing, Thursday through the following Sunday?
Correct.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell us about it?
This isn't a musical based on a movie that you've seen or your typical Broadway musical comedy. It's very different than what we've brought to the Egyptian in the past, and we hope that audiences here will take a chance on something that I think is especially relevant to the Park City community right now after some recent challenges that have happened here, and it truly is a beautiful piece that will bring a lot of hope and inspiration.
Okay. Rick, hey, appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
And that's the director of the production of Next to Normal, opening Friday night at the Egyptian Theater. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.